solve all the constraints. It was writing the delta function. In front of a wave function. And giving a kinematical state, this is supposed to produce a physical state associated to psi. And of course, it's never, you know, I mean, for more complicated systems, the point is to make that defined in some sense. And one problem being that this is a highly singular operator. So it's not a proper operator for a mathematician. And as we have seen, if you remember the simple example with where the constraints was just generating translations in the momentum, the result maps out of the kinematical Hilbert space. And you can try to make, people made more precise mathematical sense out of that, and that is, I'm not going into that. It's known as a rigging map and Gelfand triples and so on. But let us compute, so I asked yesterday, I don't know if anybody has done that. Actually, yesterday I also defined you, I told you that we have this kinematical Hilbert space and we have these solutions, and now they are not anymore in the kinematical Hilbert space in general. So actually, sometimes they are. So it happens if C has a continuous spectrum, then these things happen. If it has a discrete spectrum, if zero is in the discrete spectrum, if you have a discrete spectrum, if you remember, then you have a proper eigenvector in the sense that the eigenvector is normalizable. If you have continuous spectrum, the eigenvectors are not normalizable. Okay, so if you have a discrete zero, if you have zero in the discrete spectrum, it actually is much easier. But you can nevertheless go through all these things. But of course, in this case, it's a bit harder to define the, it's not harder, but you have to think how to define the delta function again. So I defined you the physical inner product between two physical states, which are produced in this way from kinematical states. And I define this as taking only one of these delta C's. In the kinematical inner product. So that's the definition. And people tell you that this is a transition amplitude. And I put it in inverted commas because we will see that you need to be careful to call this a transition amplitude. Okay, so what we are going to do is to calculate the thing, this one, for our beloved example, the parameterized particle, which I just write as momentum conjugated to time plus my Hamiltonian for the original unparameterized system. So for the free particle, that would be this thing. Okay. No, apparently not. So let's first calculate what is, otherwise I write too much. What is delta C applied to some state psi, P of Q? And I also told you in this case, basically, I mean, you know, I don't know if you know, but I tell you that this has a continuous spectrum. And in this case, you can write the delta function as an integral over R and you integrate over basically the generator. You treat the constraint as generator, and that will, as you will see, or as I've showed you yesterday, generate time translations for this wave function. So PT commutes with Q, with H here. So we can write this, for instance, in this way. And I told you yesterday what basically this is, just you know, what this is applied to a wave function, just that it was pq and not pt. So this gives us q plus s. Sorry, T plus S, translation in T, Q. Okay, we had that yesterday, that this generates translation in the conjugated configuration variable, in this case T. And now let me do the following. Let me PT. So let me do the following. Rewriting of this wave function psi. I write it as a delta function, as an integral over the delta function. So an integral over delta function, I'm not doing a lot. Let me check how t minus r r psi r q. And I put this definition here. So now I have two integrals. I get the delta function, which is translated. So this is t plus s minus r. And let me write it here. Okay. Psi R of Q, dSdr, and we solve for the delta function by solving for S, it's all just an exercise in rewriting. So S is equal to R minus T. H hat, and this is psi R Q dr. Okay, and we have seen that also before. That is the ingenious way how I write a solution to the Schrödinger equation, and that would be basically we call it capital Psi T of Q. So here we have T appearing, T times H bar. So if I have this form, this is how a wave function is evolved from time r to time t. And evolve means, you write it so that the Schrödinger equation is solved. So what we have here is a superposition this is a solution for arbitrary fixed R. Have a superposition of solutions to the initial value problem and these initial value, so you prescribe the initial values at time r. Okay? And all these initial values at time r are encoded in your original state psi r q. So you take, you fix t equal to r. You forgot that this was a time evolution. You take basically this to be let me write it this way to be psi r q and you evolve that to a state psi r t of q so that for t equal to r you get psi r q. Okay, I write it again. So you know that if you can superpose solutions to the Schrödinger equation, and we take all these solutions, and they have the interpretation that they are solution to the initial value problem at different times, but you nevertheless superimpose everything by integrating over R. Is that clear or is it completely puzzling? Or okay, so let's see what we get if we compute the I saw one note, so I can continue. The physical inner product. So I computed already this thing. Basically here. And I just have to take this one. So this is a kinematical that defines a physical Hilbert, the physical inner product. So I have to take this result and just integrate that against psi 1 with over q and over t. So this is 1 over 2 pi h bar times I have one integral, two integrals, three integrals, psi 1. Q t exponential minus I h bar t minus r my Hamiltonian psi r q, and that has a label 2, and now I have all these integrations. So if I would not integrate over dr and not over dt, it would give you something which is a transition amplitude for the unparameterized particle. You know, because it's just the inner product going from psi 2, evolve psi 2 until time t, and take the inner product with psi 1 q. And that is the integration over q. And that would be the proper transition amplitude if you apply the interpretation of the unparameterized particle. But you see that we also integrate over the two boundary times. So here, you know, the result indeed does not depend, does not carry any time label, yes? So which meeting? At time R. That is a, I don't know. R. So this was always an R. So I did this stupid trick. You know, t here is I wrote you the wave function, psi t of q. I just rewrote it in a different form and introduced this label r. And of course, it was an exercise just to tell you here, just to go through here, to tell you that here you should have recognized that as the time evolution of a state. So r, I just introduced R as some kind of auxiliary label, which sits in time now. But indeed, notice, so this, you know, you integrate over time, and indeed, you know, this physical inner product between these physical states do not depend on time as you usually have if you compute transition amplitudes. So you get integrated, as you can see from here, it's basically the transition amplitude. Integrated over initial and final time. So also in quantum gravity, people, you know, tell you this is a transition amplitude, but actually what it means, you know, and gravity is not so obvious what the time parameter is, but it actually means in this case, you integrate over the probability that something happens. You know, you integrate that over all instances at once, at the final time and the beginning time. So because time a priori doesn't really have a meaning, for our nice and easy example, the parameterized particle, we can, however, get back to our original transition amplitudes. Any idea how to do that? How do I not integrate over R and T? I mean, so here you wouldn't know what R and T is in general, but you don't integrate over R and T by writing a delta function, of course, again. So yeah, we will have deltas at the end of this course. So if I define, if I start with a kinematical state, you know, or let's say a physical state, because I know how to write it, oh, this is delta C delta T minus, I don't know, let's call it T1 psi anything. And this is psi 1 and psi 1. So this is to be understood as operators, which, you know, in our representation are just multiplication operators. Psi 2, then if you put that in here, you get on the left hand and here, you get two delta functions, and indeed you don't integrate, I mean, you integrate over R and T, but these will be fixed to be T1 and T2 respectively. So you get your standard transition amplitude in this case. Notice, so this would be the kinematical state you start with. And you see, you know, you could actually infer from that already lots of philosophical things about the problem of time. So this kinematical state, you know, I multiply a delta function. So is this a proper state in your, do you expect this to be a proper state in your kinematical Hilbert space? No. So it's not a proper state in your kinematical Hilbert space. So to get a sharp, you know, a sharp transition amplitude in time, you would have to start with states again, which are very singular, coming, you know, coming from the other direction. They are very singular in fluctuations, which are opposite to the constraint fluctuations. So if you so this means, you know, typically if you really want to work with states which are inside the kinematical Hilbert space, I'm not sure there's a physical justification for that, because in the end people claim that the kinematical Hilbert space is not very important. But assume you want to do that, you can only use a Gaussian. So that means, you know, you get only things which are a bit smeared. You get only transition amplitudes which are a bit smeared over time. And indeed, there's lots of thinking sometimes, or here's arguments, that this idea you can specify states exactly at one time, and it's very convenient, but it might be not very practical, or it might be that indeed if you go relativistic, you get these problems. So here you might basically do lots of philosophy about whether this sharp initial value problem is well defined. Okay. No, the Schwarz space is the one which is very nice. So it's really that the point to have an inner product, you know. So the Hilbert space is the one which in this inner product. What you can do is to go to the dual of the Schwarz space, which you anyway need to do. This is what happens here. Actually, this map, you know, you can only define not on the full Hilbert space, but on a, you have to find a dense subspace where this makes sense. And then this maps to the dual of the dense subset. And this is all called Gelfand-triple. And that's the reason why I wrote it here, because that means some dual pairing between these things. And I didn't mention that to not get people scared. But these other things is basically the question, what kind of states can you prepare? It's more a practical question. I mean, mathematically, you can do arbitrary things. But it's more a practical question. Can you prepare these states in physical terms? Which, like, it's very general hard to think about these things in quantum gravity, because also these states are kinematical. So it's not obvious what they mean. And this is, again, this is kind of inserting basically a time gauge fixing in this sense. So this inserts your gauge fixing. And then you get back to the standard unparameterized particle by gauge fixing. Okay. So let me mention, I'm here and nobody can see me. Let me mention just, so we have more stuff in the script. So I will skip the path, and so I will skip the derivation of the path integral from this thing. So I told you, you compute this thing by, you compute transition, these pseudo transition amplitudes, by writing a delta function in front of that. And of course, that is completely undefined in general systems. Completely undefined. So the general problem is that you have to find a measure which is here just ds, but in the case of infinitely many constraints, it has to be invariant under these all these gauge transformations, and this is one of the many problems. So the question is again, what do you do? And here formally, you can actually express this as a path integral. And if you have seen a path integral before, we actually see that already from here. So here I told you this only integrated over R is the transition amplitude. And you might remember that you can express the transition amplitude as a path integral. So what happens is that here you additionally integrate over R and T. So you get actually a path integral, but you integrate additionally over the boundary times here. But you can take the standard path integral and you don't integrate over the internal times. You can also integrate over the internal times. And this would correspond to taking powers of this delta function here, which you, as you can imagine, if you multiply two delta functions, you get infinity. And indeed, this corresponds to the ungauged fixed path integral where you integrate over all configuration variables. And because of gauge symmetry, which means that you have gauge orbits where nothing changes, you integrate over these gauge orbits something constant, and that gives you an infinity if the gauge orbits are infinity. So this is just to tell you that, I mean, for this parameterized particle, you can make the derivation and get to a path integral. In gravity, you cannot make a very clean derivation of that, of course. But you start with a path integral, and you hope that this computes you the thing which you want, namely the physical inner product. So now we have shifted the problem somewhere else, because now we have to construct the path integral. Also, you might remember, this is not a very well-defined procedure in itself. But there are prescriptions. the biggest problem is actually typically you have to do that via discretization. That breaks diffeomorphism symmetry. And you don't really get physical states in this sense. But you can do renormalization. And how to do that, you have to ask Sebastian at lunch. Okay, he knows everything about that. Hey, we still have one. Okay, so this, it's more or less the plan of people today, or of a subset of people in quantum gravity, to make sense out of this thing. And actually, that brings us to quantum gravity. If there are no further questions about gravity, the parameterized particle, or life and the universe. Yeah, so I told you lots of classical stuff about gravity in a form which you have not seen before. And then I told you lots of stuff about the parameterized particle. So we have done gravity and we have done a bit of quantum. Now we want to put it together. And I'm not sure we will manage path integral. It's actually very nice to see this derivation once for 3D gravity. So I will do canonical quantization because it introduces again everything what you would need to understand the 4D case. And as I told you, we have first to construct a kinematical Hilbert space. I don't know if I denoted that with curly H. So this is an H, kinematical Hilbert space. So you need a quantization of a basic set of phase space variables. On this kinematic Hilbert space. And I emphasize basic set because what you want to have is that Poisson brackets are mapped in a sense to commutators. This is one thing that you need. And there is actually a theorem that if you choose, for instance, just all polynomials on R and want to have this satisfied for all polynomials in R, this is not possible. And this is due to ordering issues. Whereas here, these things, the ordering matters. It does not matter here. And you can basically go through the exercise. And actually, if I remember correctly, it already doesn't work for polynomials of order 3 and try all kinds of orderings for x, for q and p. And you will see that you can't really realize this. So you have to choose a basic set for which this is realized. And this basic set, you also hope, has to be closed under the Poisson brackets, because if it's not closed, you just generate more and more expressions which you need to quantize. And I'm just telling you that because this is the basic point of loop quantum gravity. Once you have selected the set, there's a uniqueness theorem that tells you you don't have any other choice in this quantization. So selecting the set is basically the most basic step, and taking other sets gives, with high probability, will give you different quantizations which might not be equivalent. And this is actually the main point of loop quantum gravity to provide the set, because there's a long history. I mean, long, I don't know, from the 60s to maybe 80s and 90s. And there's still work actually to quantize in matrix variables. And still, the problem is that it's much harder to do. It's not as nicely invariant under spatial diffeomorphisms as these things, as this LQG quantization. And you, another problem is basically to quantize the Hamiltonian in these variables. You have lots of ordering issues and so on. So basically, select a basic set. Of variables another thing which I should mention because it's important to understand why the things are done in the way I'm going to do them or at least you know, I give you the motivation, is that in standard QFT, you know, you have field operators, or some people have a field psi of x, and you would say, okay, let's quantize that and put a hat over it. And indeed, you see basically most textbooks will say psi hat of x. That's my operator. So this is not an operator. It maps you completely out of your Hilbert space. It's an operator value distribution. And the thing which what you have to do is what you usually do in the slightly more mathematical careful treatments is you smear your field operators, actually before you smear your basic variable, phase space variable. This is a very nice function. For instance, this Schwarz thing. And yeah, say you have an n dimension, n spatial dimension. This is defined to be phi of x smeared over f of x. And this is just this very nice function. So it does not depend on phase space or anything. And the nice function means smooth analytic and decaying fastly at infinity. and you would basically operate with these things, and operate is the right word because these actually can be translated into proper operators. And this is what you usually have to do, but the problem is that at the same time, if you do gravity or anything with where I have a background, you would like that these things should be diffeomorphism invariant, or at least not. Should transform nicely under these diffeomorphisms. And in this way, they don't. To do that, you would have to at least insert here the determinant of the metric and the smearing. And if you do that, you have also to do that for you have also to smear the momentum with another nice function g. And again, I'm a bit short here, but I might have mentioned that momenta are always densities because they come from variational derivative of the action, which is supposed to be already the diffeomorphism invariant. So for the momenta, you don't need to insert a square root of g because it transforms as a density. And that brings already the transformation factor to make that nicely behaving under spatial diffeomorphisms. And nicely just means that this g is changed by diffeomorphisms. And now, assuming that these things, that psi and pi are conjugated to each other in the usual way, you get I'm very sorry again. Q. So I didn't use the same symbols. Okay. You get this thing. It's an integral over your spatial hypersurface with these two smearing functions. But you have the square root of Q appearing. And imagine that you try, yeah. So Q is a spatial metric, as a metric on your spatial manifold. So if you go to curved, it's not something which I will use. I'm just using a motivation. So imagine you do scalar field theory, or that these things actually come from some quantization. That these, yeah. So imagine you do scalar field theory, and on a curved spacetime, or even scalar field theory coupled to gravity. Now imagine you do that. Then the first problem is you have to find these smearings, and if you do something coupled to gravity, you want to have things behaving nicely under spatial diffeomorphisms at least. And then you have to insert this here, the square root of Q, and the spatial metric would be a variable in your quantum gravity theory. So we had the triads, and the metric is just you can compute the spatial metric as function of the triad. No pi. You don't need it for pi because the momentum is a density. So the momentum, this already defines a nice function with respect to diffeomorphisms. So we do canonical quantization, which means that, even quantum field theory, you can find canonical quantization. And in this case, you just consider the fields on a spatial hypersurface. And then you write the Hamiltonian and so on. And you can write the Hamiltonian. It's actually the time translation Hamiltonian. And it for scalar field theory is just p squared plus phi squared integrated over the spatial manifold. And you would time evolve your fields. So you might not have seen that because it's usually just in the covariant picture. But you do that. And then, OK, I tell you even something. You usually go to the Heisenberg picture, and then you don't see that so much anymore, so which means. But it is canonical quantization. And in this case, you just integrate it over the spatial manifold. So another reason is that the fields at two different times are not independent from each other. So you can only integrate after you have solved the evolution equation. But usually you don't do that because this is all the standard initial value problem, and you fix the time t here. So this is the square root of the determinant. So Q is the determinant of the spatial metric and assume you would try to quantize everything. And then you get already the square root of q here as an operator, which typically is a non-polynomial function of your metric elements and hard to do. And the general problem is that here you integrate over space, and for integration you always need some integration measure. And if you integrate over three-dimensional things, you get something on the right-hand side which is integrated over three-dimensional space, where you need an integration measure, which means that always a phase space variable or an operator will appear here. And we want to avoid this. And here, we integrated over n dimensions. And here we integrated over n dimensions. And these Poisson brackets, phi x py, they give you an n-dimensional delta function. So this means that the Poisson brackets kill you n dimensions because you put the delta functions in there. So you're left here with an integration over n dimensions. If you want to avoid this integration here, the trick is, what you do is to say, okay, let's try to smear this over k dimension, and let's try to smear that over n minus k dimensions. And then this will be smeared, the right-hand side will be smeared over zero dimensions. So we are going to do a kind of singular smearing from the point of standard quantum field theory. But funnily, it turns out to exactly agree with what you would do if you do lattice gauge theory. Again, I haven't really told you, but in lattice gauge theory, I haven't told you this in the script as a description that actually 3D gravity can be described as zero coupling of Young-Mills theory. So you see that these systems are quite related. And indeed, in a very complicated way, you can even rewrite Young-Mills theory as a gravitational theory. but if you read that, so you see that you can do this 3D gravity as zero coupling Young-Mills. And indeed, it turns out that 3D gravity is just we will quantize it in a sense as a lattice field theory, and it will be the zero coupling fixed point of lattice Young-Mills theory. And in these things, so I'll give you a preview. In lattice gauge field theory, you have variables which are called holonomies. These are functions of the connection. E. And actually, the holonomies are just parallel transporters. along a curve. Gamma. And we select these holonomies for two reasons. They behave very nicely under gauge transformations, and they behave very nicely under spatial diffeomorphisms. And they parallel transport along gamma. And as we will see, or as you might deduce, it actually means that A is a connection, which, by the way, is actually one form or covector. And covectors, if it has one index, you can always very naturally integrate that over one dimension, because you get rid of this index here. So for two, we will see that you know, if you have something, I won't call it, say, phi, and you say, if I have something with two indices, I can integrate that over two dimensions. But here you need to be careful, because that needs to be anti-symmetric. These indices, and then it's known as two form. So, but the only thing which we need now is that one forms can be naturally integrated over one dimension. Naturally means you don't need an extra metric measure there. And indeed, we will see that the parallel transporter appears with the connection integrated over 1D. And it's actually over exactly this group, this curve gamma, that we have to integrate our holonomy. Okay, so I told you we are going to take these holonomies. Which are smeared over one dimension. And they're functionals of the connection. So what else do we need? Had these A variables, and then we had another set of variables. E. We need also the triads. And we have to smear that over how many dimensions? N minus one, indeed. So it's N minus one. Which is for 3D gravity. One, because it's a two-dimensional hypersurface. And these things will be called fluxes, because they will be exactly like the fluxes which you might have encountered in electrodynamics. Just, you know, smeared over these edges. And in general, you do that over all edges and have to compute the Poisson brackets between these things, which, I might do if there's time. I have to think about it, or if you're interested, or whatever. In three-dimensional gravity, we do that, you can do that for general curves gamma and here general curves gamma prime. And in our lectures, we will just restrict to short edges. Short doesn't really make any sense here because we don't have a metric yet, but edges here and dual edges, which just means these are edges which, edge E prime is dual to edge E if they transversely cut into each other for the fluxes. And so in the next lectures, I have to explain you what a connection is, what a holonomy is, and I have to define you these fluxes. And then we already have our kinematical Hilbert space, which will be associated to these edges. So we first just consider the quantum theory associated to one edge. And that is an extremely nicely mathematical well-known quantum theory. It's a quantization of the tangent space of SU2. So it all gets a bit technical because I have to explain you what SU2 is. But the overall plan is that we consider edges. That is a kinematical Hilbert space. And then we are in three dimensions, so we slowly build up triangles that solves this old guy Gauss. Get rid of Gauss. And tetrahedra is already something which is kind of three-dimensional. So we really have to solve the dynamics. I told you, I made some funny claims like the flatness constraints generates time translation. So that means we have to solve the flatness constraint. The nice thing is that we can all do that in 3D kind of easily if you know lots of stuff about SU2. So I have to tell you lots of stuff about SU2. It might get a bit boring in between, but this is what we have to go through. If you want to understand the thing I told you at the beginning, that the wave function of a spherical universe is given by a 6J symbol, and as you might guess, the 6J symbol, you might have heard, it comes from recoupling of angular momentum, which is related to SU2. Okay. So let's see each other tomorrow. I guess I don't give another lecture today. There are no more questions.